Yeah, so thank you. Thanks, Robert, for giving me this opportunity to talk. Also, I mean, I would say thank for the toy model so that I had this paper out. And yeah, it should be published soon in New Journal of Physics. So I'm a student of Dan Brown, so maybe you guys know him. And so I'm going to talk about the... can you hear me?
Yep.
So the toy model and the relationship with quantum mechanics, in particular these results that we have that extend the theory to all dimensions and we find the measurement update rules. So the outline of what I'm going to talk is the following. So I will give like my personal review and motivations behind the toy theory. And I first start with the bit case, so systems of dimension two that probably most of the people know about, or I mean, at least maybe it's more known. And then I will generalize it to the general case of systems of continuous dimensions and discrete prime dimensions. In particular, I will focus on systems of discrete dimension because then we want to use it for purposes in quantum computation. So after that, I'm going to give our contributions, so the measurement update rules for the prime and the non-prime case. And then at the end, I'm going to tell you something about a recent project we've been working on that says that sub-theories of the toy theory can be used to represent the non-contextual classically simulable part of state injection schemes, where then the contextuality is injected with the magic state to bring universal quantum computation. I will also give some comments on the relation between stabilizer quantum mechanics and the toy theory. So let me start with the motivations. Here I'm going just to list some questions that I think the toy theory addresses in the field of quantum foundations. And so you know, probably the biggest one is, what does a quantum state describe? Is it a state of reality or is it a state of an epistemic state? So a state of partial knowledge that an observer has about the reality, so a state of belief. The other is how to classify the inherent non-classical features, in particular in a scenario where we are very permissive with what is a classical theory, and also to reformulate quantum theory from physical intuitive principles, so outside the Hilbert space for formalism. And so let's see how the toy theory answers to this. Okay, so first of all, so the Speckenstein model is a non-contextual hidden variable model made to support the epistemic view of quantum mechanics. So states, quantum states, are seen as states of partial knowledge that we have about a deeper underlying reality. And the idea of the model is to see if quantum mechanics can be reformulated as a classical phase space inspired theory with the addition of an epistemic restriction. So a restriction on what the observer can know about the reality. So it's like saying, look, maybe quantum theory is not that mysterious. It's like a classical theory where, by some physical principle of nature, we cannot know all the reality. And so here the idea is how to see what is this epistemic restriction here. And yeah, sure. Yeah.
Parts of the model itself, right? It's not something additional put in by hand, right?
I mean, it's something additional. So it's something additional that we put on the symplectic structure of the theory. So we have the yes, I would say yes.
Is that fair, Rob?
From the epistemic restriction, then you so all the concepts. So for example, we showed that the date rules derives are dictated from how you put the epistemic restriction. If you change the epistemic restriction, the theory changes. So yeah.
I guess I was just wrong.
It's consistent with the dynamics in the sense that you can put the cut anywhere you like. So I can treat the measurement externally and just sort of impose the restriction on system, or I could switch it back and say, no, the measurement measurement device is another system, and I impose a restriction on the pair, and then I treat the internal dynamics of the measurement meeting the system. And you can show that regardless of where you put the cut, it all makes the same predictions.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you're very welcome to ask questions, and I'm happy to hear all the contributions of people. So I want to start with the case of dimension 2, as I told you. Here, our elementary system and considering is the one of 1 bit. So we call these 4 boxes 1 bit. It's our elementary system. And what is the reality of this system? So the reality of the system that we call the ontic state is one color box among the four. So for example, this means that the system of 1 bit is the ontic state 1, or we can have 2, 3, or 4, OK? So how do we get the knowledge of the ontic state? We can imagine to ask binary questions in order to get the knowledge of where it is. So the first one is it on the left or is it on the right? So that one was on the left. Then we can ask, in these remaining two, is it on the left or is it on the right? It's on the left. So you see, if we can answer 2 binary questions, we get the knowledge of where is the ontic state, where is the reality. But as I told you, here we have an epistemic restriction. So it means, in particular, this epistemic restriction says that at maximum, we can answer just 1 of these 2 questions. So if you want to be more precise, this principle, in this case, is called the knowledge balance principle. And it says that if the observer has maximal knowledge about the ontic state, then the knowledge he has to equal the knowledge he lacks. And what does it mean in our case? If we can answer just the first question, then we end up with this state here, OK? But other possible states, and I call these epistemic states, so are states of partial knowledge that I have about the ontic state, can have this one or this one. And if, for example, I cannot answer any of the question, I have the state of complete ignorance, so I don't know anything, OK? So now here I've listed all the possibility for the 1-bit case. These are all the epistemic states of maximal knowledge, and here is the epistemic state of where I don't know anything. And you can see already that I can make the analogy with quantum mechanics for 1 qubit. For example, I can imagine this to be the pure state 0, this one, and so on. And this one, obviously, is going to be the completely mixed state. Okay. So now, in order to define a theory, you know, we need to define also what are the measurements, what are the transformations, what is the operational statistics that is provided by the theory. So the measurements here are just the binary questions we are asking. And if you remember, we were asking, is it on the left or is it on the right? We can represent this measurement in an epistemic state way, if you want, so where each element of the measurement is given by this sort of epistemic state representation. And for example, this measurement here, is it on the left or is it on the right, is going to be the analog of measuring on the 0-1 basis, so the Z measurement. In terms of transformations, the transformations are permutations of the ontic states. But this transformation has to be such that the epistemic restriction is preserved. So I need to go from one allowed epistemic state to another allowed epistemic state. Okay? So for the 1-bit case, we have all the permutations. Then we can go to the case of a couple of bits. And here, the idea is that we want this knowledge balance principle, so this epistemic restriction, to hold both for the individual subsystems and the overall system. And you can check that the two possible patterns that we can have in the maximal knowledge that we can have, maximal knowledge epistemic states, are these two of these two kinds, up to permutations of rows and columns. But the point I wanted to highlight here is that in the left case, we have a sort of product state. Because you see, say that our subsystems are represented in the y-axis and x-axis, then you see that, for example, if I perform a measurement on the one subsystem, say this one, so saying, is it on the left or is it on the right, I get the knowledge of this maximal epistemic state without disturbing the other. So in a sense, we have this uncorrelation between the two. So we know the individual states, but we don't know their relation. Instead, on the left, we have the opposite case. We have a sort of entangled state. Because we cannot know like the individual states of the we have no information about the individual states, but we know with perfection the relation between their ontic states. So in this case, they are either both 1 or both 2 or both 3 or both 4. OK? Yep.
Can And the epistemic restriction on a multipartite state be completely specified by the, you know, kind of bitwise restrictions, or are there additional restrictions on the correlations?
So here is bitwise. So it's, I mean, it's in terms of each individual system has its own, and also for the overall has to hold. So the other thing I want to highlight is that here we see, so first of all, we see how we represent here entanglement in this sort of classical theory. And we see also that this trade-off that either you know the individual states or you know their relation is something that is not present in any pure classical theories. Okay, so by endowing the theory with this epistemic restriction, we start to see how we see the distance from classical, pure classical theories.
So if instead of there being four blue squares on the diagonal, there's only two, that would be an allowed state?
So you mean these two white?
Yeah, two.
Yeah, no, it's not possible.
So that's not allowed. Okay, that was my question. Because that's, because pairwise that would, or rather bitwise that would so satisfy the restriction, right? You would only know the horizontal bit was on the left.
So I mean, you have to have at least four color boxes. If you have less than when you perform a measurement, you could infer the ontic state of one of the two subsystems. I mean, I didn't want to spend too much time on this thing, but just if the idea is clear, then maybe we can work out all the examples later. Okay. And so what I was saying, so I wanted to highlight this fact. So how we can start seeing the quantum phenomena.
There's an assumption here that the state, whether it's ontic or epistemic, it's giving you information about what the system is doing at that time corresponding to the state. Whereas I think the real answer is that the state is non-locally related in time to the underlying reality. In other words, it's really information about the past. So I just want to throw that out
as a sort of third option that's not alternatives, the way you presented it.
So I don't know if I really got what you said, but
yeah,
maybe you're referring to the fact. So it is possible in the toy theory to get the knowledge of the ontic state at a previous time, but it's not possible to get it at the time you have the state. Is this the thing you are saying?
The wave function represents a kind of partial summary of the past. That's
how I think it actually, its role in the path integral formulation.
And yeah, so what's the question again?
No, it's not a question, it was a comment.
Okay, sorry. Okay, yeah, good.
I just put it out there because.
Yeah, it was
I think
good.
There's a third possibility beyond the two that you presented us with in the beginning. Because it implicitly assumes that the wave function refers to the reality
at the time at which it's defined.
Okay, that's interesting. Okay, so we can discuss it later. So what I want to say is that now I want to go to the general case of systems of discrete prime dimensions. And I mean, the intuitive way in which I want to try to do this is just the following. So imagine that we have our two states here that I showed you before. Now we can imagine to label these states in terms of x's and p's. And imagine these, so d by d grids, as our phase spaces. And you see that if we do this, now we can interpret the ontic state as one point of the phase space. And we can also define our epistemic states in terms of which variables we know. For example, this epistemic state on the left is the epistemic state where we know x1 to be 0 and we know x2 to be 0. In this case, you can see also again why we have a sort of entangled state, because we cannot say which are the values of these variables. We can say only that we are going to have x1 equal to x2 equal to p1 equal to p2. Okay, so here is the intuition. So now we can go into a formalization of the toy theory, where our ontic space is a phase space. In our case, it's at d to the 2n. I'm considering the discrete case. The dimension d here is considered to be prime dimension. And n is the number of systems. Then we have seen that if we assume we have this canonical variables, x's and p's, then our ontic state is a point of the phase space. And we can specify it listing the coordinates of that point. Then we can define observables. Observables are going to be given as linear functionals in this phase space. So they belong to the dual phase space, but it results that is the same as it did to the 2n. And we can give, again, a vector representation of them. What is important here is that there is a very simple relation to relate the outcome of an observable once we have the observable and the ontic state. This is going to be given just by the inner product. Okay? And what is the epistemic restriction here? So here is called the classical complementarity principle. It says that when an observer has maximal knowledge about the ontic state, then it means that it can maximum jointly know the values of variables that Poisson commute. So was Poisson brackets are zero. So we are now in the phase space. We have each variable, x's and p's, and observables. We can know them together if the symplectic inner product is zero. And the symplectic inner product is given by like the inner product with the j, OK? So when we have, when we can know something is the value of the variables that symplectic commute. So I'm going to use the term commute without saying symplectic or Poisson just to say that they, their symplectic inner product is zero. Yep. OK?
In your formulas, are all the numbers modulo p or something?
Yep.
Right?
Yeah. Yes, modulo d.
Modulo d.
Yeah. OK. So now that we have our epistemic restriction, we can define our epistemic state. So how do we define an epistemic state? So if you remember, for example, we had, I don't know, say we have one treat. OK, here was x, here was p. We have, for example, this epistemic state. So here is 0, 1, 2, 0, 1, 2. So for example, we said this is the epistemic state where I know x equals 0. So you see, to define an epistemic state, we need to say which are the variables that we know and which are their values. So here is just one case. So we have just one variable. But in systems, when we have more systems, we can have more variables. And so we can define an epistemic state by specifying a subspace V, which is isotropic in the sense that all the elements have to commute, because we can only know together variables that commute. And by a vector, which is our evaluation vector, our or shift vector, that tells us which are the values of each generator of our isotropic subspace. So the generators are the variables that we can know together, and that generate all the ones that we know. And these are all commuting, again, all symplectic inner product zero. The omega will give us the correct outcome for each one. Okay. So by specifying V and W, we specify our epistemic state. Now we can ask ourselves which are the ontic states, like here these three, that are compatible in general with an epistemic state. The answer is that these ontic states has to live in V perp plus omega. And you can actually easily see why V perp plus omega, because if you consider all the ontic states that belong to V, these are such that the inner product with the generators is zero. But then if we shift them of W, the inner product becomes the correct outcome. So you see why we have V per plus W. And since here we don't have preferred ontic states, we say that our probability distribution describe our epistemic states on the phase space is uniform and is given by the delta of these ontic states on V perp plus omega. So this delta is 1 when lambda, so the point of the phase space, which is our ontic state, belongs to V perp plus W, is 0 otherwise. So this is a possibilistic theory. Are you OK with this? OK, just to give an example, say that we know the x to be equal 1. This is our epistemic state. So we can see that v is going to be given so by the span of 1, 0, because you know, for 1,
treat what one did. We have this as the observables. If we know x, it means that we know a, which is equal to 1, and b, which is equal to 0. So that's why expand 1, 0. Then we can see that omega that evaluates x to 1 is 1, 0. Also 1, 1, or 2 could be OK. And then we see that if we take v per plus omega, we get this, which is actually what we expect. So the epistemic state where we know x to be equal to 1. Okay, now we can see the value transformations. Since our underlying ontic theory is symplectic, is the phase space with the symplectic structure, then our valid transformations are the symplectic affine transformation. So affine means this translation, and S, this symplectic matrix, is such that it preserves the epistemic restriction. So it preserves the symplectic inner product, of course. So it maps epistemic states to epistemic state. We can also associate a conditional probability distribution to the transformation, so that, which is just, again, the delta over this possible transformation. And it gives us the probability of getting lambda, given that we had lambda prime. Then we can see the valid measurements. Again, so there is this duality between states and measurement, like in quantum mechanics. And indeed, like measurement can be represented in an epistemic state way. Say that we want to, here is an example of one treat again, say that our observable is x. The possible elements associated to knowing x are x equals 0, x equals 1, x equals 2. And you see that for each one, we can give the epistemic representation. Where you can see that v pi is equal for all of them, they change just for a shift in the evaluation vector. So actually, we already have the information about the measurement, just consider one of those. We can also associate a probability distribution, which is the same as it was for the epistemic states, to the measurement. And this will give us the probability of getting the outcome k given lambda for our measurement pi. Okay. Now we can also provide, so what is the operational statistics provided by the theory? It's going to be given just by the law of total probability of these probabilities. So say that we want to know which is the probability of outcome k, given that we measure so v pi with the transformation Sa on v omega, then we just compute the law of total probability and we get the statistics. So if you want to find which are the sub-theories of quantum mechanics that are compatible with the toy theory, they have to provide, yes, the same structure, but also the same statistics. Okay. So just to conclude this review, so here I stole the table from Rob's paper, where we see the achievements. So on the left-hand side, there are the phenomena that were thought to belong only to quantum theory, but actually can be reproduced in the model. And I would say on the right-hand side, there is this answer to the second question we had at the beginning, which are the inherent non-classical features. And according to this model, contextuality and non-locality are the features that cannot be reproduced, so that they are inherently quantum. Yeah?
So the last item on the right says certain aspects of items on the left.
Okay, so I think... the idea, I wanted to tell you, don't ask me about any single of these, but I think that is the following. I mean, in the toy theory, we don't have all the states of quantum mechanics. For example, for one bit, we have only the six pure states, which are the one of the stabilizer octahedron and the mixed state. For example, in there, you can do teleportation. I mean, for what we think is mysterious about teleportation. But if you go to quantum mechanics, you can say, oh, but here you can do teleportation also with others, with these other states, blah, 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 that you don't have in the toy theory. They say, yes, but what we want to say when we say that we have phenomena, that are represented here, is that we can capture the what was thought to be the mystery of that feature. Am I saying it? Okay? Then, I don't know, for more detailed questions, ask Rob about this. What I want to say is that in a sense, we want to answer how the toy theory answers the first three questions. So it supports the epistemic view of quantum mechanics. So this model wants to support quantum states are epistemic states. He says that the non-classical features seems to be related to contextuality and non-locality. And in a sense, has tried to reformulate quantum theory where the physical principle, even if here is not yet physical, is this epistemic restriction. So we have some restriction by nature on what we can know. Okay. The last thing I want to say that is important for us. Yep.
I noticed it said you can, the things you, on the left, it had entanglement, but on the right it had Bell inequality violation. So what does that mean? You can get a certain amount of entanglement, but not...
Yeah,
not
I mean... I mean, there are different ways of quantifying entanglement. What I say is that the way in which, you remember I show you an entangled state, as a state in which you know with perfection the relation between the subsystem, this is what encodes the notion of entanglement. Then you cannot do with this notion here also violation, you cannot construct a violation of Bell inequality. So yeah, in the language of quantum theory, usually we say that you need a certain amount of entanglement.
Sometimes describe entanglement as the state of maximal knowledge of the joint system is not the product state of maximal knowledge of the individual systems. And I think that's what it is had here. Is that right?
Say it again.
There are states of maximal knowledge of the joint system that cannot be expressed as just a product of states of maximal knowledge of the individual systems. And so the toy model has this.
These are our entanglements.
People often would take the Bell inequalities as the sort of...
I agree. Entanglement means a lot of things to a lot of people.
Entanglement is necessary but not sufficient for Bell inequality violations.
So we have bound entanglement.
But no Bell inequality violations.
Yeah, we have these Werner states where it shows that you can have entangled state without violating Bell inequalities. So what I want to say also is that so if we go to... So in odd prime dimensions, so odd dimensions, the toy theory is operationally equivalent to stabilizer quantum mechanics. And this can be proven by using gross Wigner functions. And this is what I'm going to talk about in a bit. So at this point, I want to tell you about our contribution. So I haven't talked about measurement of date rules so far, and that's what I'm going to do now. Just before telling the measurement of date rules, I want to highlight again the things that we need in order to follow now. So the first one is again that epistemic states are specified by an isotropic subspace of known variables and an evaluation vector. And the corresponding probability distribution is over V perp plus omega. So what we want to find here is which is V prime and omega prime, and in particular V prime perp, where prime means after the measurement. And then that also the measurements have this epistemic representation, each element of the measurement. So what we want to do is to find the state after the measurement given by V prime omega prime, so then V prime perp, given that we have the state V omega and the measurement V pi r, okay? So how can we, treat this problem? We need to reason in terms of how we describe the measurement process in the toy theory. So if you think, the measurement process is always a process where we want to learn information about the ontic state. So you remember, we were asking binary questions in order to know the information about the ontic state. But the toy theory says that we cannot learn as much information as we want. We have a restriction, okay? If you think of these isotropic subspaces in terms of their generator, so in terms of the variables that we can know, the classical complementarity principle tells us that we can learn only the generators of the state that do commute with the generators of my measurement. Therefore, the state after the measurement is going to be given by the generators of a measurement and the generators of the original state that commute with my measurement. So the interpretation of the measurement process is very clean and is dictated by the epistemic restriction. So now, what is the point to make it formal? The point is to understand what happens to the isotropic subspaces when I add and when I remove generators, okay? So now I'm gonna do a couple of slides a bit technical, just to justify my results. So first of all, what happens when I add the generators? So say sigma prime, which is say linearly independent with all of these. And add the generator sigma prime to V, what happens is that the V after the addition that I call V prime is gonna be given by the direct sum with the span of this sigma prime. So I can list all the new generators and these are gonna be given by the sum. And it's well known that if I take the perp, this is gonna, V prime perp is gonna be given by the intersection of the perpendiculars. So if you add the generator to your isotropic subspace, you get the intersection of the perpendiculars, okay? What happens if instead we remove a generator, say for example, sigma n, to our isotropic subspace? So of course, V prime is gonna be given by the span of all of these generators apart from sigma n. And now I show you that in terms of the perp, what you get is the original perp direct sum with Vn, which is the span of sigma n. And the idea is just that if you want to find V prime perp, we need to add all the ontic states because V prime perp is gonna be bigger than V perp. Such we have to add all the ontic states such that they are still zero with the sigma j from 1 to n minus 1, but they are different from zero for sigma n. And the way we can do this is if we add this kind of states, so C gamma, where C is just an integer that multiply gamma, and gamma is such that the inner product with the sigma n is 1, so gamma belongs to sigma n, to Vn, yeah. So now you can see indeed that we get something different from 0 for sigma n and something equal to 0 for the sigma j's, and you can add all these kind of ontic states to V perp. What you end up in having is this V perp direct sum with Vn, as I show you. So just to recap, when you remove a generator, your perp is of this kind. So you do the direct sum with the generator that you remove. Yeah.
So you're using a lot of language. It sounds like vector subspaces.
Yeah, so but it's a vector subspace.
Unless D is prime, you don't really have fields. So are you saying it doesn't make any difference?
Yeah, well, in prime dimensions, then I'm going to non-prime.
Now you're in prime dimensions.
Now I'm in prime dimensions, yes. Uh-huh. I'm going to non-prime in a bit. Okay? So, now I want to tell you the measurement of the truths. First, in the case in which we have commuting measurements, so all the generators of my measurement commute with all the generators of the state, which means that I have a non-disturbing measurement, like in quantum theory, if you measure the state 0 on the basis 0, 1, okay? So in this case, as I show you, we have just to add the generators. Add the generators means that I have to take the intersection of my original subspace with the subspace of the measurement. Where here we need to be careful about on what we do the intersection, okay? That's why I put also here, I have also this shift vectors. And here is the reason. So what we have to consider is that the original state is in V per plus omega. The measurement is in V pi per plus R. So the intersection we want is this one, okay? So now if you want to map it back to the origin, we have to translate by omega prime. So that's why I have it in here. And you can bring it outside the intersections, okay? So I mean, it's just an intersection. Then we can also find the updated, so what is omega prime? We need to find the update shift vector, and this is gonna be given by the original one plus a shift, okay? That depends again on the gamma that we used before. And I want to anticipate that this gamma is gonna be the main problem in non-prime dimensions. So just to give a quick proof of this, imagine that we have the measurement given by just one generator, say sigma prime, was associated, outcome is small sigma prime. Then we can imagine that our omega, so the shift vector of the original state is not, has to be updated, so it's not okay with this outcome. This means that it gives us a shift to the outcome, so sigma prime plus x. Now you see instead that we want to find omega prime, which instead has to give us the correct outcome. And you see that if omega prime is given by omega minus x gamma, where gamma is again the usual, so inner product with the sigma prime equal 1, if you substitute, you see that you get exactly the correct outcome. If you then rephrase x in terms of omega and r, you get exactly the above formula, where here we consider a sum because in the case in which we consider many generators, we need a sum, okay? And the last technical thing I'm saying is that if we are in prime dimension, this gamma is given, is unique and is given by this k to the minus 1 sigma prime. As you see here, it's defined in terms of k to the minus 1. This k to the minus 1 is not always defined in non-prime dimension. And we will see then how to face the problem there, okay? So here, just to give an example of this commuting case, very simple. We have the state where we don't know anything. We measure on this state. Then the intersection is what gives us the state of the measurement. The non-commuting case is like the commuting case, so an intersection. But as I told you, we need to remove the degrees of freedom regarding the non-commuting part because we cannot know the non-commuting generators. So the idea is to decompose our isotropic subspace in the parts that commute with the measurement and the parts that doesn't, that I call the other. And you can prove with the, when we saw how to remove generators from isotropic subspaces, that this V commute perp is given by this formula. But the idea is the same. So you take the intersection of two subspaces, but now from the original subspace, you have to remove the non-commuting part. And so, good news, the shift vector is the same as before, so we don't need another proof. Here an example, say that we have the state p equals 0, and we measure x minus p, so equals 0 here. Then we have to remove the generator from here, because it doesn't commute, and we get the completely unknown state. Then we take the intersection, and we get the state of the measurement. So for people who are, I don't know, falling asleep about the technical part, this is just a quick recap. So we have seen measurement update rules in the prime case. In the non-disturbing commuting case, these are given by the just intersection of the perp. In the disturbing non-commuting case, these are given again by the intersection, but where we so average out all the degrees of freedom that do not commute. And the updated shift vector is just this one, where we had to define this gamma, which has this relation with the generator of the measurement. And this gamma comes in both in V commute and this updated shift vector. So the problem here is that this gamma is not always defined in non-prime dimensions, while in prime dimension it was that k to the minus 1 sigma.
The gamma doesn't have to be unique here, right? Many choices of gamma.
Yeah, there are many choices.
But in non-prime dimensions, there's
no choice. In non-prime dimensions, the point is that you cannot define inverses of numbers. And every time here, you need to introduce the calculation of inverse of a number. That's the easiest way to look at this. But what I wanted to highlight here is that the fact that this gamma not always exists actually shows that there are two classes of observables. One kind of observables that are problematic, so in the sense now I show that they don't have a full spectrum of outcomes, and some observables that are okay. And in non-prime dimensions, only non-prime dimensions, there are also problematic observables. But now, so I want to define what do I mean by problematic observables. So by definition, I call them coarse-grained observables. It means that are observables that they don't have a full spectrum of outcomes. What do I mean by a full spectrum? For example, imagine that we go in d equals 6, and we consider the observable 3x. So in d equals 6, we can only have 3x equal 0 or 3x equal 3. Because if you consider 3x equal 1 or 3x equal 2, we have no values of x that give us something. Okay? It's not possible, because we have to consider modulo d as the arithmetic. So these are the coarse-grained observables. On the contrary, we define observables that have a full spectrum as fine-grained observables. So in d equals 6, for example, is x. X can be equal 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 without any problem. It's a fine-grained observable. So you see, we have coarse grain observables and fine grain observables. Now we need to find a way of formally write these observables, okay? So, and there is a theorem, I'm not going to prove this here, that says that fine grain observables, so with the one with full spectrum, if and only if they can be written in this form. So just so here I'm doing in one only one generators, only one system for simplicity. But you remember the observable was AX plus BP, the general one. Okay. So here it says that fine-grained observables are the ones for which A prime and B prime do not share any integer factor or power factor of D. On the contrary, coarse-grained observables are the ones that do share some degeneracy. So you see, you can group out a D that they call degeneracy from A and B. And this D so is made by integer factor or power factor of D. And why is it important to write so coarse-grained and fine-grained observables this way? First of all, we can prove that gamma exists if and only if the observable is fine-grained. And because we can see how to decompose a coarse-grained observable into a fine-grained. Because you see, once you group out the D, the thing remained inside now is a fine-grained observable. So for example, here in D equals 6, you see that if you have the coarse-grained observable 3x equals 0, this can be decomposed in its three fine-grained observable, x equals 0, x equals 2, x equals 4. So now the idea for the measurement date rules, I'm not doing the proof because they're very technical, is that you get, so in order to get update rule when you have an observable like this, is to find update rules in terms of the corresponding fine-grained observables and then get the union of these. Indeed, what you get at the end is this thing. So you have the same, you remember the intersection of the perpendicular, but now the intersection is done with the fine-grained observables, and then you do the union over all these fine-grained observables. And I mean, for the shift vector is a similar reasoning. So,
that's a question.
Yes.
So in quantum theory, if I'm projecting onto a two-dimensional subspace of a three-dimensional system, there are many update rules, but one difference would be, you know, do I preserve the coherence between those two levels or not? So von Neumann actually in his textbook sort of wrote down an update rule that destroyed the coherence between levels one and two if you projected onto that two-dimensional subspace. And it was only Luders afterwards who said, no, let's consider the update rule that preserves the coherence between those two levels. The way you defined your update rule using the fine-grained versions, it seems like it's an analog of von Neumann's and not Luders, that it seems like...
Would
you agree with that?
Okay, yeah, I don't know if I understood very well. So the argument is if you have a three-level system versus two-level system.
Yeah, so let's call the levels one, two, three.
Yes.
And the projectors onto them pi one, pi two, pi three.
Yes.
So the CP map that corresponds to finding the outcome pi one plus pi two, so in one of the first two levels, could be just Krauss operators pi 1 plus pi 2, so it's just the projector onto the 2D subspace. Or it could be two Krauss operators, you know, pi 1 and pi 2. And so when it's the two Krauss operators, it means any coherence between those two levels is destroyed, whereas the first option preserves coherences between those two levels.
Yeah, so it seems more in line with the first option.
That's my sense.
Yeah.
The von Neumann one that destroys coherence.
Coherence destroying.
It seems like the analog of the coherence destroying one. You agree?
Yeah, I agree. I need to have a deeper thought on this. I was thinking how this is implied by the epistemic restriction. I don't know. I think we can.
I had a related, I suppose related question, which is at least what Rob mentioned before, it seemed to imply that you have not only a rule, but you have a sort of measurement scheme that would justify this rule. In other words, there's some sort of coupling of a measuring apparatus to the system and some update for the joint system that's an allowable update for the joint system.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I was thinking how the Yeah, I was thinking that's why I think the epistemic restriction is crucial in order to justify this approach, because it's telling you how the measurement process works.
So it's true that there is this whole, in principle, or I mean, you haven't told us, but there is this whole protocol for realizing any of the measurements you talked about. Is that true?
I mean, the protocol is just that you have to add the generators together and remove.
No, I mean, but you need.
I don't know what's protocol.
Would be introducing some sort of ancillas that would record the results of the measurement. I mean, it would be.
You can do essentially a von Neumann type model where
that
you
kind
of probe, and you shift that probe depending on the value of whatever variables you're trying to measure on the system. So you just have to kind of shift some degree of freedom of the probe by an amount that depends on this, like a sort of controlled operation. So you can do that.
Then for the particular.
Yeah, so why is it crucial, this thing about these measurement truths?
Why is it crucial to have this?
Well, I'm not sure it's crucial, but if you want to move the cut the way Rob was saying,
that's I agree. Yeah.
And some sort of internal consistency, the property or condition of the whole update rule, that it should be realizable. I mean, for example, in quantum field theory, you can invent update rules in measurements, and they're not realizable because they allow for superluminal signaling. And I think no one even knows a whole scheme that's consistent in that way. So, for quantum field theories. So it's a good thing if the theory, I would say, if it does admit this self-consistence protocol for measuring anything according to the update rule that you've specified. But then I guess then the question would be if this is more like this, whatever the von Neumann and not like the Luders, then is there also another one that's like the Luders rule? And is there a protocol for that?
Probably
the answer is probably no.
There is no sub-theory of quantum mechanics with Luders rule updating that admits of a model of this sort.
That's a negative feature in some sense.
It makes Luders rule updating a kind of strong kind of non-classicality.
Is it strong? Yeah.
So then
you might add to the right-hand side of that list Luders rule.
Right.
I mean, we don't know, I guess, from what you're saying.
Yeah, so the time is running out. I wanted to just talk about the relation between the toy theory and stabilizer quantum mechanics. So I guess most of you know very well stabilizer quantum mechanics, so I'm going to be quick. Well, just to say that so here is a sub-theory where we consider states that are joint against states of tensors of Pauli operators, and we define them in terms of their generators. So we have n systems. We can write each generator, each rho j in terms of the generators. So for example, if d is 2, we have just two terms. But the point is that I'm going to refer to our stabilizer states in terms of their generators. And we can do the same for the measurements. The transformations here are the Clifford ones, so they map Pauli to Pauli and they preserve the commuting relations. And the update rules, so say that we have our state rho and our measurement pi, that are given g1, gn, p1, pn, then has the same structure of the toy theory. Because in the non-disturbing case, we have to add the generators of the state and the measurement to get the state after measurement. And in the disturbing case, we have to do the same, but we have to remove the non-commuting one. So what I think is interesting is that in the toy theory, this structure is dictated by the classical complementarity principle, and by the same structure. Then we can...
So could there be more than one non-commuting generator?
Yes.
Okay. So,
yeah, here is just an example.
Okay.
And then we can represent stabilizer quantum mechanics in odd dimension with gross Wigner functions. the theorem says that if D is odd, then if you have, so say you have a pure state, then it has no negative Wigner function if and only if it is a stabilizer state. The Wigner function in general given by the trace of rho A lambda, and Gross proved that in the stabilizer case they are given by this delta over the isotropic subspace and the vector that defined the stabilizer state. Okay, here I also put the definition of the so the phase point operator is just sum of our Weyl operators. The Weyl operators are just so these generalized Pauli operators. Here I've also I mean the interesting thing here is that there is this analogy between what we do in the phase space and what it corresponds in terms of stabilizer operators, because Weyl operators commute if and only if the corresponding phase points have symplectic inner product zero. So that's how the hidden variable here works. And here I put also an example just to say that it's exactly like an epistemic state. Indeed, we can see the equivalence between epistemic states in the toy theory and gross Wigner functions in all the dimensions just by noticing their form. You see, it's the same. The map is just that in gross case, you have to consider this isotropic subspace, which is M with the symplectic inner product. But if you assume M to be JV, so you apply the symplectic J to all the coordinates of V, then you get exactly the same formula. I mean, this transformation just gives you the conjugate coordinates, so from X, P, and so on. So there is not something deep about that. The point is that these are operational equivalent theory. Also, because in terms of the transformations, for example, we have the gross Wigner function, which is covariant, so it works okay for symplectic affine transformations. And so they are exactly operational equivalent theories. They give the same statistics and they have the same structure. The point is that, before going to the truths, the point is that this equivalence is true only in odd dimension. Because when you go to qubits, then you don't have this kind of gross Wigner functions. You always have negativities. And this is related to the fact that qubit stabilizer quantum mechanics is contextual, while the toy theory is not by construction. Okay? Now that we have this equivalence between stabilizer and the toy theory in all dimension, I want to draw this equivalence in terms of the update rules, because I think it's very elegant here. So here, just to say that from our measurement update rules, we can find also the ones for gross theory. So when we had the intersection in the commuting case, this is mapped to a product rule in the Wigner function. When in the non-commuting case we had the intersection and the, you remember, so removing all the non-commuting degrees of freedom, this is mapped to a product and an averaging out of these degrees of freedom. And you can see now like this table where we have non-disturbing measurements in the three theories that correspond here to our generators, here to make the intersection, here to make the product. In terms of disturbing measurements, here you have two odd generators and remove the non-commuting ones. Here to make the intersection and considering V commute, so do this direct sum. Here, do the product and average out these degrees of freedom. So I found it very nice in terms of mathematical structures. And we can see also non-prime dimensions, but just didn't want to spend many words on this. So here in non-prime dimension, the toy theory has also this union of the intersection, and in terms of the Wigner function, this is mapped to another sum over all the degeneracies. So if everyone's happy with that, I just want to spend the last minute to say this. So this idea we have been working on recently, because the question we want to ask now is, okay, the toy theory is operationally equivalent to stabilizer quantum mechanics in odd dimension. And what about qubits? Because it's not operationally equivalent to the stabilizer quantum mechanics. I told you we have negative Wigner function, we don't have the operational equivalence. But it might be that, so it might be, we want to find which are the maximal sub-theories of the toy theory, which are operationally equivalent with some sub-theories of quantum mechanics. Okay? And there is also an extra here. So the first thing is, as I told you, which are the sub-theories that are consistent with quantum mechanics. And then we want to use these sub-theories two unified frameworks of state injection schemes, where then the contextuality is injected with the magic state. Okay? And the reason I want to do this is because all the known examples of state injection schemes fit in this framework, where you have the class, so the part which is classically simulable, usually is played by stabilizer quantum mechanics in all dimension. Then you have your magic state. And with this, so by injecting here the contextuality which was not present here, you get universal quantum computation. And you say that contextuality is necessary for quantum computation. So we want to map all this example in this framework. So people like Joel and so can say, oh, you can do better the Speck-Hensteuer model here. You can use the eight-state model and so. Or you can use the framework of Rausendorff, where you allowed the gates to bring in negative linear function. But my point is that in all the examples that we know that do not fit here, but fits in their case, you can always remove some parts in the classical part such that you can still get universal quantum computation with the same magic state. And now the classical part with these removed things fit in Speck-Hensteuer model. So in a sense, it's like if you are abandoned in an island and you're starving to death, and your only aim remains to reach universal quantum computation because you want to get the salvation or whatever, then if your gates that you have for the classical simulable part fits into the what we define as Speck and subtheories, and then you have the magic resource, then you can get universal quantum computation. And with this, I mean, here I just put, I think I'm out of time, what was what is our definition of Speck and subtheories, but the idea is there are closed subtheories that are operationally equivalent to quantum theory. And I mean, with this I want to conclude. So we have seen measurement update truths both for the prime and the non-prime case. We have seen them also for gross theory of linear functions. We have seen the equivalence between Speck-Hensteuer model and stabilizer quantum mechanics in odd dimension and in terms of their update truths. We have this question of what happens in the case of qubits, what is the part of quantum mechanics that is operationally equivalent to the toy theory, and we have seen that maybe it can be used for some tasks in quantum computation. Thank you, and if you have any questions, I'll try to answer.
Do you have any intuition for why the Luders rule might not fit into the toy theory? And is it does it have something to do with the fact that you can't sort of embed smaller subspaces like a two-dimensional toy theory isn't a sub-theory of the three-dimensional?
The question is why you cannot include in the toy theory what? The qubit
version of a Luders rule update as opposed to.
Let's say I have a three-level system and I start off in the state 0 plus 1 and then I measure whether it's in the 0, 1 subspace or the 2 subspace. According to Luders, it stays 0 plus 1. It keeps the coherence between those two levels. But according to von Neumann, it gets transformed to an incoherent mixture of the projector onto 0 and the projector onto 1. So von Neumann would say, just measure the 0, 1, 2 basis and forget whether you got the 0, 1 outcome. That is a measurement of the projector onto the 0, 1 subspace. But it's one that destroys coherences. Whereas Luders said, no, there's a way of implementing that measurement that doesn't start by the fine-grained measurement, but instead just does an intrinsic measurement of that 2D subspace. So David's question is just, if indeed there is no analog of the Luders rule, update rules, but only the von Neumann type update rules.
So, I have to think about it, but my guess is that, again, this feature is dictated by the classical complementarity. So I would say that, again, also, I mean, if you want to find, I don't know, try to find other quantum behaviors, you have to try to change the way the epistemic restriction works. This is my, I think. So, I don't know.
Further to that, the Luders rule acts as a resource. If you have arbitrary stabilizer operations in basically any dimension, and you can do coarse-grained projectors onto stabilizer states via Luder's rule, then you can project stabilizer states onto magic states, and then you get universality. So,
yeah, which is essentially what you're saying, that if you allowed Luder's rule update, you would go outside the space of epistemic states that are considered valid in the theory. So yeah, the epistemic restriction essentially forbids Luder's rule type updating.
So maybe I agree with this, but I don't know if I'm misunderstanding this Luther's rule. Is it related? So David, do you remember when you told me?
It's also called projection rule sometimes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It really helped me out if I could just see the Luder's rule and then
yeah.
The alternative.
Lorenzo, should I write down just what
okay,
we
no.
Okay, so if we're measuring, you know, the projectors pi k, then von Neumann would say that rho goes to sum over k. It's a bad way of doing it. Let's just write the Luder's. Luder's rule would be rho goes to pi k, rho pi k. That's it. And so
conditional outcome k.
Yeah, that's right. If you get outcome k from that. In particular, this pi k could be the projector onto a two-dimensional subspace. And therefore, it preserves any coherences inside, any off-diagonal elements in a row inside that two-dimensional subspace are preserved.
What's the alternative?
Let's suppose pi, a particular one of these guys, pi naught, is written in terms of some pair of states, some pair of 1D projectors. Okay, so then Luder's is just rho goes to pi naught rho pi naught, whereas von Neumann says that rho goes to the incoherent sum of these guys. So you just ask, what's the probability of zero in rho? Prepare zero with that probability. What's the probability of getting one on rho? Prepare one with that probability.
Does he really do that?
Yeah, that's what's in von Neumann's textbook.
Yeah.
This is also called the projection postulate, which is what you'll find in all the modern textbooks. And often you'll find people calling that von Neumann's proposal. And that's
Is it fair to say, I guess, that von Neumann just assumed all measurements had to be fully fine-grained and that all you could do is forget stuff?
Yes.
That's right.
That's a strange assumption. It almost never could be realized.
It's kind of not even self-consistent. Like, you could append non-interacting auxiliary systems. Now it changes what you mean by a fine-grained measure. Yeah.
Your position measurement, you're never going to get exact. It's not like having a bunch of detectors that will precisely determine the positions. So.
Yeah, I was thinking about something else.
I remember David asking if you had this case that you measure either on zero, or so how was that? You have 1, 2, isn't it?
Is it the same question? Yeah, because the point here is that this state is not in the toy theory, because you would need to have this and this. Oh, shit. And this one is not possible one. So I think, is it related to this?
Yeah,
that's why we have a von Neumann type.
But if you go to your example from dimension 6, it's kind of a different character than this one, where your coarse-grained measurement is something that you could imagine existing in the theory. Yeah. So there's a sense in which that coarse-grained measurement is, you know, closer to being valid than this one we're talking about here. But we could again imagine, you know, so this quantumly would be something like a six-dimensional.
Yeah, it should be like something like either you measure on 1, 1 plus 3, 3 plus 5, 5,
right.
Comma 2, 2,
exactly.
4, 4, 0, 0.
And so for that case, there's this question of, do I measure project onto that three-dimensional subspace directly, or do I project incoherently into three one-dimensional subspaces within that three-dimensional subspace?
I think it's
And I think the reason is that if you allowed Luder's type updating,
that's
you would go outside the set of valid states.
Yes.
Other questions?
I just want to follow up on. It looked like it came from 6 not being prime, but I take it the problem is there also if D is prime. Is that right? Six is not even odd. Not odd.
So the example, so it exists for D equals 3.
It also exists.
I have a question that doesn't relate to this Luder's rule business. Earlier, Raphael asked, how do you have, like a lot of the representation in the prime dimensional case sort of relies heavily on a vector space representation of the symplectic structure. But when you have non-prime dimension, what do you do mathematically in that case? It's not a vector space anymore. It seems like in one of your final slides, it looked as if you were talking about vector spaces in the non-prime dimensional case, like in your final tables. But I guess we're not to interpret that as a vector space, but something else.
Yeah, so what happens in the... I think in terms of the proofs I did, the point is that the fact that the structure is a vector space is not used. So you can get the update rules anyway. Then what is the object that you're considering? I know that there are all this work on Galois fields, all these things, but yeah, I haven't addressed that part. We have put all of these as a future directions in the paper saying, oh, maybe by noticing this analogy with the stabilizer and the toy theory of the non-prime dimension, you can infer something on the stabilizer. But we have put as an open question. Therefore, it's interesting to get to know it.
More questions?
Let's thank Lorenzo again.